The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where I shall be continuing my narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic, focusing on Pompey and Caesar. Last time I left off talking about the early life of Pompey. I shall continue with that for a few more bits of Plutarch. It's mainly Plutarch for Pompey's early life. And I'll either keep doing that for the whole rest of this episode, or at some point, if I catch up with the year when Caesar starts appearing and doing things, I'll switch over to Caesar again in Plutarch. Both the early lives, it's really Plutarch, I'm afraid. Appian only really picks up the story once high politics and things are going on. So for the early life of both Pompey and Caesar, it is Plutarch. So we'll see how far we get. I hope you enjoy. Okay, let's dive right in. If you remember last time, I left off where Pompey had had some great successes in Sicily and North Africa. He was still a very young man, still in his early mid-20s. So I'll pick up after he had conquered Sulla's enemies in North Africa and then subjugated the king of Numidia, Plutarch tells us. On his return to Utica, which is not far from Carthage, right near what was Carthage, on his return to Utica, he was given a letter from Sulla instructing him to send his army back to Italy, except for one legion, with which he was to remain himself in Africa until another general came out to supersede him. This was a message which grieved and distressed Pompey very much, but he did not show his feelings openly. You wonder how Plutarch knows that. A quick note just to say, Plutarch was writing quite a long time after Pompey. Decades and decades, nearly 100 odd years later. More than 100 years later. And Plutarch never really tells us what sources he was using. We can only imagine Plutarch did have access to all sorts of sources which are lost to us. The archives, the Roman archives. Lots of historians which just didn't survive through the millennia to us. So how he got sort of inside information, essentially, we don't know. Occasionally he will mention a name of a previous source, perhaps a primary source that actually lived during the age of whatever he's talking about, but largely not. And even when he does mention the name to us, it's sort of just a name. You know, scholars and historians mark it down as a lost history, and that's about all we can do. Anyway, he continues, Pompey was distressed but didn't show his feelings openly. His army, on the other hand, made their indignation perfectly clear. When Pompey urged them to go home before him, they shouted out against Sulla and declaring that they would never forsake their general, told Pompey not to trust himself to the tyrant. That's dodgy. If Sulla hears of that, he's not going to be happy. As for Pompey, he tried first to calm the men down by speaking to them in a reasonable way, but when this had no effect on them, he came down from the platform where he stood and retired to his tent in tears. The soldiers, however, seized hold of him and made him stand on the platform again, and so it went for a long time, with the army urging him to stay there in command and Pompey begging them to obey the orders and not to start a mutiny. Because if they'd mutinied, Pompey would have been in deep trouble at that point. You know, it might have been his head. So he really didn't want the men to mutiny and Sulla to find out about it. Finally, as they became more and more urgent and noisy in their demands, Pompey swore solemnly that he would kill himself if they forced him to act as they wished. And even then, the clamour only gradually died down. The first news of this that came to Sulla was to the effect that Pompey had revolted, and he remarked to his friends that he was evidently fated, now that he was an old man, to have boys for his antagonists. He said this because Marius too, who was quite a young man, that's the young Marius, the Marius's son, had caused him much trouble and involved him in very great danger. However, when he learned the truth and saw that everyone was hurrying out of Rome to welcome Pompey and to show their goodwill, by escorting him back to the city, he quickly decided to outdo them all. He went out himself to meet him, and after greeting him in the warmest possible manner, addressed him in a loud voice with the name of Magnus, or the Great, and told all those who were present to salute him in the same way. Others say that this title was first given to him in Africa by the whole army, and that Sulla's confirmation of it merely gave it weight and force. Pompey himself, however, was the last of all to make use of it. It was only after a long time, when he was sent to Spain as proconsul to operate against Sertorius, that he began to sign letters and decrees as Pompeius Magnus. By this time, the title had become well known, and the use of it could not cause offence. So Pompey showing a bit of humility there. In this connection, one cannot help feeling respect and admiration for the ancient Romans. These titles and surnames of theirs were not only given as reward, but for success in war or in military leadership. Achievements in civil life and the abilities of statesmen were also honoured by them. In two such cases, the title of Maximus, or the Greatest, was bestowed by the people on Valerius for his services in bringing the people and the Senate together when there was a rift between them, and on Fabius Rulus, because he expelled from the Senate a number of people who were descended from ex-slaves and had got themselves enrolled in as senators because of their wealth. Those are characters from much earlier in Roman history. Pompey now asked for a triumph. The request was opposed by Sulla, who pointed out that legally this was an honour which could be given to a consul and a praetor, but to no one else. For this reason, the first of the Scipios, after his victorious action against the Carthaginians in Spain, actions which were on a bigger scale and more important than anything Pompey had done, did not ask for a triumph, because he was neither a consul nor a praetor. And if Pompey, who had scarcely grown a beard as yet, and was too young even to be a senator, were to ride into Rome in a triumphal procession, people would be angry not only with Sulla's government, but also with Pompey himself for receiving such an honour. Therefore, so Sulla said to Pompey, his request could not be allowed, and he would oppose him and put a stop to his ambitious plans if he refused to give way. Pompey, however, was not in the least frightened. It's quite remarkable. He asked Sulla to bear in mind the fact that more people worshipped the rising than the setting sun. A bit rude. Implying that while his own power was on the increase, that of Sulla was growing less and less. That's very brave to say something like that to Sulla. Sulla has people killed for such insolence. Sulla did not hear these words distinctly, but the looks and gestures of those who had heard them showed him how astonished they were, and he asked what it was that had been said. When he was told what it was, he was astonished at Pompey's audacity and cried out twice in succession, "Let him have his triumph! You know, I like your moxie, kid." "All right, we'll do it." Others too were angry and indignant at the idea, and in order to annoy them all the more, Pompey is said to have planned to make his triumphal entry in a chariot drawn by four elephants. He had brought over from Africa a number of elephants, which he had captured from the kings. However, the city gate was too narrow, and so he had to give up this idea and fall back on the conventional horses. And when his soldiers, who had not got a large reward as they expected, showed a tendency to mutiny and to disturb the proceedings, Pompey declared that it was a matter of complete indifference to him. He would rather forego his triumph than try to curry favour with his troops. It was on this occasion that Servilius, a man of great distinction, and one who had been very much opposed to Pompey's triumph, said, "Now I see that Pompey really is great and does deserve his triumph." It's as though Pompey considers himself too important to be putting down mutinies anymore. That sort of thing's below him. It is clear, too, that at this time Pompey could easily have become a member of the Senate if he had wished to do so. But Pompey was not anxious for this. His pursuit of glory, as they say, always took an unlikely or an unusual course. And in fact, there would not have been anything very surprising in his becoming a senator before he had reached the proper age. The really dazzling honour was to have a triumph when he was not a senator at all. This was something which had a considerable effect in making him popular among the ordinary people, who were delighted to find that after his triumph, he was still officially included among the equestrian order. That is quite remarkable, isn't it? It's like having a presidential ticker tape parade without ever having been president or something, you know. And again, that's one of my favourite anecdotes of Pompey. The fact that he asked for a triumph from Sulla. He shouldn't be allowed to have one. Sulla said no. And he just said, I'm going to have my triumph, old man. And Sulla said, "All right, you've got it." I mean, again, it speaks of a charisma, doesn't it? Sort of a cheeky, a likeable cheekiness You know, some people can really, really push their luck and even be rude, but people like you all the more for it sometimes, you know. Sometimes people that are extremely good at roasts, comedy roasts, for example, it doesn't cause offence. People think you're funny and they like you all the more. Anyway, Plutarch continues. Sulla was far from pleased when he saw how Pompey's reputation and power were growing, but he was ashamed to interfere and so did nothing about it. Again, he doesn't want to show resentment. It's sort of beneath you to respond in a way. That's how Sulla's seeing it. Very sort of haughty. Probably the right way to play it, though. He did show his annoyance, however, on one occasion. This was when, acting in direct opposition to Sulla's wishes, Pompey had got Lepidus elected to the consulship by helping him in his canvassing and using his own personal popularity to win the support of the people for Lepidus. When Sulla saw Pompey leaving the forum with a great crowd following him, he said, "Young man, I can see you are delighted with your victory, a wonderful thing indeed, and a most generous action to use your influence with the people so that Lepidus, one of the worst men living, should get more votes at the election than Catulus, who is one of the best. It is about time, however, that you wake up and give your attention to what is happening. What you have done is to make your opponent stronger than yourself." Again, any sort of rebuke from Sulla should be taken very seriously. Sulla's not the sort of man to sort of warn you or tick you off more than once or twice before you wind up dead or at least exiled or something. You know, it'd be very scary to be chewed out by someone like Genghis Khan or Nero or Stalin. If you get chewed out in any way by Sulla, you know, I'd start trembling. Pompey seems to have taken it in his stride, though. Plutarch goes on. But the clearest proof that Sulla gave of his ill feeling against Pompey was in the writing of his will. There were legacies for all his other friends, some of whom were appointed guardians to his son. But Pompey's name was not mentioned at all. Pompey, however, bore this in a very decent, sensible way. In fact, when Lepidus and others tried to prevent Sulla's body from being buried in the field of Mars, or even from having a state funeral at all, he intervened personally and saw to it that the ceremony was not only carried out in security, but with every mark of honour. So there, without saying so, Plutarch has let us know that Sulla's died. And if you remember the episodes on Sulla, it wasn't long after his dictatorship that he died, that his body got completely corrupted with worms or maggots or something, and then he died. Plutarch says, Sulla's prophecies were fulfilled shortly after his death. Lepidus tried to grasp for himself the power which Sulla had held, nor did he go about it in any roundabout way or with any pretense of legality. He took up arms immediately, based himself on a revival of the old factions now long enfeebled, or rather on what had been left of them by Sulla. His colleague, Catulus, who could count on the support of the best and healthiest elements both in the Senate and among the people, had a reputation for good sense and just dealing, which was second to none of the Romans of his time. On the other hand, he was thought to be more at home in political than in military leadership. Events themselves, therefore, seemed to call for Pompey, and Pompey was not slow in deciding which side to take. He attached himself to the cause of the nobility and was given command of an army to operate against Lepidus, who had already succeeded in making a large part of Italy revolt, and who, with a force under Brutus, was in control of Cisalpine Gaul. So we can see there a type of civil war, very small-scale civil war starting to break out. You know, it's a bit more than just civil unrest in Rome, in and around the Forum. You know, Lepidus has put himself in charge of an army in Cisalpine Gaul, and Pompey's had to raise a counter-army. So, you know, we're bouncing straight back into the days of Marius and Sulla, it looks like, or beginning to, the first inklings of that sort of thing. But Plutarch continues, saying, Pompey attacked and subdued with ease most of the rebel forces. But at Mutina in Gaul, he was engaged for a long time in besieging Brutus. During this time, Lepidus had made a quick dash on Rome and had encamped outside the city. He demanded a second consulship for himself, and with his huge crowd of followers, he brought the citizens to the verge of panic. Their fears were dispelled by a letter which arrived from Pompey, stating that he had won the war without having to fight a battle. Whether Brutus betrayed his army, or whether his army changed sides and betrayed him, we do not know. In any case, Brutus surrendered to Pompey, and, after having received from him a cavalry escort, retired to a small town on the Po. Here, after one day had passed, he was put to death by Germinius, who was acting under Pompey's instructions. Pompey was much blamed for this, for directly after Brutus's army had changed sides, he wrote to the Senate to say that Brutus had come over to him of his own accord. And then in a second letter, after Brutus had been killed, he produced evidence against him. This Brutus was the father of the Brutus who, with Cassius, killed Caesar. Neither in his own wars, nor in the manner of his death, was the son like the father, as may be read in his life, i.e. that's Plutarch's own life of Brutus. So Plutarch bigging up his own writing there. See my other book, if you're interested in that. But that is an interesting note, isn't it? That Brutus, once the actual war breaks out against Caesar, he is on the side of Pompey. But Pompey had killed his father, basically. So that's interesting to note how politics, when it comes down to it, or civil wars, you end up quite often making bedfellows of people that would otherwise absolutely be your bitter enemy. But when you have to choose a side, you know, you might think that Brutus would side with Caesar, that he might have a vendetta in his heart against Pompey for the rest of his days. But no, he ends up essentially, definitely siding with Pompey, Pompey's side of the Caesar-Pompey civil war. As for Lepidus, he was driven out of Italy and crossed over to Sardinia. There he fell ill and died of despair. The despair was not, apparently, caused by the failure of his policy, but was due to his coming upon a letter which proved that his wife had been unfaithful to him. So, a broken heart. Meanwhile, there hung over Rome, like a cloud, the menace of Sertorius, a very different sort of general from Lepidus. Sertorius was now in control of Spain. The poison of the civil wars had, as it were, come to a head in him, and he represented the last stages of the disease. He had already put an end to the careers of many inferior commanders and was now engaged with Metellus Pius, who was a distinguished man and a good soldier, but was considered to be handicapped by his age, no longer quick to seize the opportunities of war and liable to be left behind by events when they occurred quickly and suddenly. For the methods of Sertorius were close to a robber chieftain. His unconventional attacks, his ambushes and his flanking movements had a disturbing effect on a man whose whole training was in regular pitched battles and who commanded troops which were heavily armed and lacking in mobility. So this Sertorius is a very interesting character. Sertorius is one of the main characters in this period, who history doesn't end up ranking him as highly or as importantly as people like Crassus or Pompey or Caesar, but he is sort of up there, certainly. If you read the sources and you're familiar with the story, Sertorius is up there because he just seems to be a great general. He seems to be doing blitzkrieg stuff, or seems to be doing Napoleon-style hit-and-run things. He's very creative. Caesar is known for his speed and his creativity. He always turns up where people don't expect him to turn up. Julian the Apostate was like that. Many, many great generals are like that. They turn up where you don't think they're going to and when you don't think they're going to all the time. And Sertorius is one of those guys. So he's a great commander, someone to fear if you're against him. Plutarch goes on, though, that, quote, Pompey therefore kept his army together and tried to arrange to have himself sent out to reinforce Metellus. Catulus ordered him to disband his troops, but instead of doing so, he kept on making one excuse or another and remained under arms near the city until the Senate gave him the command on the motion of Lucius Philippus. So that's cheeky. Again, that's sort of quite illegal, quite highly illegal. The consul tells you to disband your army. And you're like, no, shan't. No, don't think I will, actually. Thank you very much. That's pretty bad. That's more than being cheeky. That's more than bending the rules. That's completely breaking the rules in one of the worst ways you can. But Pompey gets away with it, as always, or nearly always. They say that on this occasion, someone in the Senate expressed surprise at the proposal and asked whether Philippus really thought it necessary for Pompey to be sent out with the status and power of a consul. Not of a consul, replied Philippus, but of the consuls, implying that in his view, both of the consuls for that year were quite useless. Pompey, he's our man. If he can't do it, no one can. Pompey's arrival in Spain produced the effects which normally followed the appearance of a new commander with a great reputation. The troops on the spot, with something fresh to look forward to, became changed men. The Spanish tribes, which were not bound by very close allegiances to Sertorius, began to grow restless and to show signs of deserting his cause. Sertorius therefore began to make and to publicise a number of contemptuous references to Pompey. I should only need, he said, mockingly, a cane and whip to deal with this boy if I were not afraid of that old woman, Metellus being the old woman. In fact, however, he watched Pompey closely and out of fear for him showed much more caution than previously in his general conduct of the campaign. As for Metellus, so Pompey's reputation is preceding him there. As for Metellus, though no one would have expected this of him, he had become very luxury-loving and had given himself up entirely to his pleasures. His whole character had suddenly undergone an alteration, and he was now both extravagant and ostentatious. These defects in Metellus served to increase Pompey's reputation and made him extraordinarily popular, since his own way of life was a model of simplicity. Not that this cost him much effort. He was naturally a temperate character and was in complete control of his desires. There were many changes of fortune in this war. What upset Pompey most of all was the capture of Luro by Sertorius. He had imagined that the enemy was surrounded and had boasted of the fact. It then suddenly appeared that he was surrounded himself. He was afraid to move and had to look on while the city was burned before his eyes. However, he won a victory near Valentia against Herennius and Perpenna, Roman exiles who had joined Sertorius and had been given command of armies by him and killed more than 10,000 of their men. So just to make it clear, this Sertorius is sort of setting himself up as a completely rogue element in the Roman Empire, or the Roman Republic, that this Sertorius seems to be trying to set himself up as almost like his own sovereign in Spain. That he, you know, he's not answering to the Senate, the government of Rome, in any way. And he's putting himself in charge, a complete rogue agent, and handling affairs very well, it seems. Worryingly well from the point of Rome and the Senate and Pompey. Plutarch goes on. Flushed with this success and full of confidence, he then hastened to engage Sertorius himself, being eager to win a victory without Metellus having any share in it. The two forces joined battle near the river Scuro later in the day, and both generals were anxious for Metellus not to appear. Pompey, because he wanted to fight without anyone to help him. Sertorius, because he wanted to fight without anyone to help his opponent. As it happened, the battle was indecisive. On each side, one wing won and one lost. But so far as the two generals were concerned, Sertorius had the better of it. The troops under his personal command routed those who were opposed to them. Pompey was less successful. He was fighting on horseback and was attacked by a tall man who was fighting on foot. Charging at each other, they came to close quarters and each struck the other on the head with his sword. The sword strokes, however, were not of equal force. Pompey was merely wounded, but the hand of the antagonist was cut right off. But now enemy troops in still greater numbers bore down on him. His own troops were already routed. He made his escape from what seemed to be a hopeless situation by abandoning his horse to the enemy. The horse had golden ornaments on its head and other trappings of great value, and while the enemy fought with each other over the division of spoil, Pompey himself got away. Classic. They were more interested in the gold things on the horse than in actually capturing or killing the enemy commander. At dawn on the following day, both armies formed up with the intention of making certain of the victory that had so far eluded them. By now, however, Metellus was approaching. Sertorius retired and his army scattered in different directions. These were his usual tactics, a total dispersal of his forces followed by a rapid mobilisation, so that at times Sertorius would be moving about the country entirely on his own and at other times would take the field with an army of 150,000 men, like a winter torrent suddenly swollen with rain. When Pompey, after this battle, went to meet Metellus, and they drew up near to each other, he ordered his lictors to lower their fasces, that's the sort of axe that the lictors hold, to show his respect for Metellus as his superior in rank. Metellus, however, would not allow this, and in every other way too treated Pompey with the greatest consideration. Though a man of consular rank and Pompey's senior, he claimed no special rights for himself, except that, when both armies were encamped together, the watchword was issued to the whole camp from his tent. Usually, though, they encamped apart from each other, and indeed, they were constantly finding their communications cut and their forces separated as a result of the unpredictable tactics of Sertorius, who had a genius for appearing almost at the same moment in a number of different places and forcing them to fight now here and now there. In the end, by cutting off their supplies, by laying the country waste, and by gaining control of the sea, he drove them both out of his area of Spain and forced them to retreat to other provinces because of lack of provisions. So that's interesting there. Pompey, that's a defeat then, ultimately. A strategic defeat for Pompey. You know, he's sort of defeated in battle, although not exactly. Plutarch calls it indecisive. But, you know, a type of battlefield reverse. And although he wasn't completely bested or utterly routed or massacred to a man or anything like that, he was sort of bested in battle. And then on the grander scale, strategically, he was forced to retreat. So that's one of Pompey's, well, it is Pompey's first big reversal. So his reputation is marred a bit there. Before now, he'd been sort of completely undefeated. And later, he sort of still claims he's completely undefeated. You know, it's like the United States claiming they've never lost a war. That's if you don't count certain things, like the War of 1812 or Vietnam or something. But no, still, piss off a lot of Americans by saying that. Maybe I'll cut that out. Anyway, but Pompey has to go away and lick his wounds, essentially, and rethink the strategy and get more men and materiel before he can keep going forward. Plutarch tells us then, quote, "By his experiences on this war, Pompey had already run through most of his private fortune. He now asked the Senate for money and threatened to come back with his army to Italy if his request was not granted. Lucullus was consul at this time. He was not on good terms with Pompey, but he did everything that he could to have the money sent. This was because he was trying to get himself appointed to the command against Mithridates, and he was afraid of giving Pompey any excuse for returning home, since Pompey would have liked to have left Sertorius alone and gone out against Mithridates himself. It would be a command that would bring him much honour, and Mithridates seemed a much easier proposition than Sertorius. About this time, however, Sertorius was treacherously murdered by members of his own party. Perpenna was the leader of these, and he now attempted to take Sertorius's place. But though he had the advantage of the same army and the same resources, he had none of Sertorius's talent and ability in making use of them. Pompey took the field against him immediately, and finding that his strategy was entirely haphazard, lured him into a trap. He sent out 10 cohorts and ordered them to scatter over the plain in loose order. Perpenna attacked them and was beginning to pursue them when Pompey appeared out of the scene with his entire army. Battle was joined and Pompey won a complete victory. Most of Perpenna's officers were killed in the battle. Perpenna himself was brought to Pompey alive and Pompey ordered him to be put to death. Some people criticised Pompey for this, saying that he was lacking in gratitude and had forgotten what had happened in Sicily. In fact, however, he was showing excellent judgment and a most valuable sense of the public interest. Perpenna had come into possession of Sertorius's correspondence and offered to produce letters from some of the most important people in Rome who, wishing to start a revolution and change the existing form of government, had written to Sertorius, inviting him to march on Italy. Pompey, however, was afraid that this evidence would simply be the occasion for greater wars than the ones now ended, and so he put Perpenna to death and burned the letters without even reading them himself." End quote. That's interesting. I mean, maybe that's a smart political move. Maybe that is, probably was, the most prudent thing to do. Pompey doesn't want the Roman world, the Roman Republic, to be endlessly torn apart by civil war. But you would think it might be best to actually read them himself, at least. You know, maybe not make them public or have them reprinted or send them back to Rome or anything, but probably read them yourself. I know I would, just to have the inside track, just to have, or maybe I'm being too cynical, but, you know, just to have something on some of the other men if you need it later in life. But Pompey wasn't a great politician, really. We'll get into that over the coming Epochs episodes. We'll see that he's naive in all sorts of ways.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.